goal with any kind of foresight work, any kind of scenarios or futures work, is to provoke you into looking differently at the world. You know, the term that I like to use because it sounds fancy is, you know, scenarios and forecasts are epiphany engines. You know, they are meant to trigger in you, be catalyst for you having an entirely new view of the world. You have that aha, well, I never saw it that way moment. And the idea with all of these forecasts is not to tell you, you know, this one has a 33.2% chance of happening. It's to say, this is something in the realm of plausibility. How would you respond? What does this mean to you? And that's actually true for nearly every scenario project I've worked on over the past 25 years.
Author and futurist Jemay Cassio joins the Plutopia podcast as we explore the future of a world undergoing chaotic change. Selected by Foreign Policy magazine as one of their top 100 global thinkers, Jemay helps us understand a world in chaos, rapid global disruptions, climate change, and scenarios about the future, often with an environmental focus.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Plutopia podcast. Our guest today is Jemay Cassio. Jemay is a writer, scenario consultant, world builder, future-focused thinker. He's explored the intersection of environmental dilemmas, emerging technologies, and cultural evolution for over 25 years, specializing in plausible scenarios of the future. Jemay, how's it going?
Well, take a look at the world around you.
Oh, no, I didn't think you'd bring that up.
Yeah. No, it's a very strange profession to be a futurist these days, to feel like there are persuasive arguments that our future is limited. Now, I don't think that's the only argument to be made, but it is certainly part of the conversation. And to be honest, I don't know a single professional futurist who's not on antidepressants right now. And I'm completely serious about that.
Oh, I believe you. I completely believe you. So you're working at the Institute for the Future. Is that your primary gig now?
Well, yeah, I'm not actually an employee there. I am a long-term contractor, distinguished fellow, which gives me a top hat and monocle.
You are a distinguished fellow.
Well, thank you very much. I've been working with them on various projects since 2007. I'm one of their longest lasting associates. You know, there are most of the employees there have been there for less time than I have. I work on a variety of projects with them. Right now, I have two big projects with them that I'm working on. One is from the state of California, a 100-year forecast and a set of scenarios for the state of California. And I finished the 10-year block. I'm about to work on the 30-year block. And then we'll be doing a 100-year block of scenarios. And I'm the primary writer on those. The California people are like the sound of my voice. They want me to actually read the scenarios for the exhibition that'll be going around. So that'll be fun.
You do have a great voice.
Well, thank you very much. The other project I'm working on, I actually literally just a few minutes ago got out of the meeting for this, was for the UN Development Program is doing a project on ethics and emerging technologies. And so we're talking about we're trying to figure out a good framework for what are broad ethical questions that can be applied to a whole range of different technological developments. Things from, you know, does it impede access or does it improve access? What's this impact on human rights? What are the impacts on various moral questions? You know, does it insult human dignity? Some things, you know, the language is a bit more precise than that, but it's an interesting conversation to be had. We're not nearly done with it. And it's been fun to think through the variety of issues that fall under that rubric of ethics and technology. It's allowed me to actually dig back through a role-playing game book that I wrote 20 years ago, because it was, you know, set in a science fiction, plausible science fiction future, and it was all about culture and belief.
Is that a Steve Jackson Games book?
It is. It actually, right here. Toxic Memes. Steve Jackson Games for the Transhuman Space.
Boy, that sounds like a very predictive book.
I had some good stuff in there.
Can I still get a copy of that book?
You can, PDF only, but you can.
Okay, I'll look for that.
Steve Jackson Games, yeah.
I'm just thinking it must be really hard right now to create realistic scenarios in the middle of all this chaos and craziness.
Yeah. Well, it's not so much that it's difficult to create realistic scenarios. It's difficult to create scenarios that have any sense of hope. Now, I actually do still have hope because I know that with all of the problems we're facing as a planet, we actually know what to do to resolve them. We have the tools, we have the ideas, we have the knowledge, we have the capacity to deal with global climate catastrophe. We have the capacity to deal with global issues around water and food. But the question is, do we have the will? Are we willing to do what it takes? And so my hope comes from knowing that we can do it. My fear comes from doubting that we will. And so I've long described myself as a short-term pessimist, long-term optimist, but that short-term has been getting longer and longer and longer. And at this point, I honestly don't think I'm going to live to see the optimist part of the model.
I was looking at your resume and you write about BANI, brittle, anxious, nonlinear, incomprehensible. Can you explain that concept versus the old one done by the Army War College at VUCA? What's the difference there?
So in the late 1980s, as the Cold War was winding down, the U.S. Army War College started to create a framework, a language framework, to talk about the kinds of disruptions that they were starting to see, that they wanted to basically reify, give a structure to a world of disruption. And so they came up with this VUCA model, and it's everyone talks about it as VUCA. It's volatility, uncertainty, complexity, ambiguity. And it's very much a product of the post-Cold War era. The rise of the internet era, that feeling of everything's kind of disruptive around us. These are disruptions to our to the norm. What we've seen over the past 30 years since then is that disruption has become the norm. The joke that I make in when I give talks about this is we eat VUCA for breakfast these days. It is our normal reality. We swim through it like a fish through water. And in that environment, talking about a VUCA situation, a volatile situation or uncertain situation, just feels unhelpful. So in 2018, I actually started working on an alternate framework, initially for a project with the Institute for the Future, but they said, go ahead and run with it. And so it's moved beyond that. And it's this BANI concept of brittle, anxiety-inducing or anxious, nonlinear, and incomprehensible. The terms that are really as subtle as a brick, but they're meant to describe aspects of or manifestations of chaos in an already disrupted world. So when we look around, we see that our systems are failing. Big systems are failing. And are they failing? Some of them are failing because they are brittle. That is, they appear strong, they've functioned very well for us, but they've just hit a sheer point in terms of stress, and they go from functioning to collapse very quickly. We see that, and that's actually very much a product of having a high efficiency just-in-time economy, because when that works really well, and when it breaks hard. And we see some of the impacts of the pandemic have really illustrated how brittle a lot of our economic systems are. We've also started to see how brittle our political systems are. how brittle democracy can be. Because it turns out there is a level at which you put pressure on a democracy and it starts to just shatter. Anxious or anxiety inducing is a way of articulating just that sense of there are no good answers. You know, the feeling that you just hit the last off ramp and there's not another one for 100 miles. And so it's that feeling of almost existential dread, because nothing seems to be working around you. So is this chaos something, you know, is the manifestation of chaos something that is making you feel hopeless? And so there's a lot of the malinformation, you know, misinformation and error and confusion that we're seeing across our social media is really a strong pressure on anxiety, inducing anxiety in people. Because a lot of that misinformation in particular is designed not to convince you that something false is real or something real is false, but to make you doubt whether anything is real. You know, doubt validity. And so it doesn't matter if you actually do believe the Q conspiracy theories. It does matter if you have hesitation about voting for a Democrat because, you know, what if they are actually cannibalistic pedophiles with Jewish space lasers or whatever. The third is nonlinear. And here's where climate really gets to rear its ugly head. You know, nonlinear processes are where the inputs and the outputs are really disproportionate. They're disproportionate in scale. They're disproportionate in speed or in time. One of the big issues around climate is that it's a hysteretic process. That is, there is a long lag between inputs and outputs. Arguably, you know, I've seen numbers. The most recent is it's about 10 to 20 years. I've seen up to 50 years. Lag between the introduction of greenhouse gases into the atmosphere and the output of changes in temperature and environment. So we could stop putting any carbon dioxide, any greenhouse gases into the atmosphere right this second, zero, and we would still see warming, continued warmth, but continued increases in temperature for at least 10 years, possibly up to 30 or 50. And so think about that not just as a geophysical problem, you know, not just as an environmental problem, but think of that as a political problem. If you have convinced your society to make radical disruptions, radical changes to their ways of life, and then nothing happens, you know, there's nothing gets better. That's a massive political issue, and that's derived from the nonlinearity of the climate process. We see this across the spectrum. Pandemics, you know, the spread of pandemics is inherently a nonlinear process. It's very common in nature. You know, the issue is that we are accustomed to thinking in terms of linear, you know, straightforward, additive and multiplicative processes. It's very hard for us to wrap our minds around exponential processes. And unfortunately, a lot of the big issues that are hitting us now that are causing the most chaos have this exponential nonlinear aspect. And finally, with incomprehensible, that's actually the one I get the most pushback on. Because incomprehensible for a lot of people means that eventually we'll understand that. It may not be understandable now, but eventually we'll understand it. Fine. What I mean is that what we are seeing are examples of systems or processes or devices that behave in ways that we cannot fully explain, you know. Especially, this is a particularly salient around artificial intelligence. You ask, you know, the European Union has recently passed regulations that will eventually require companies to explain the decisions made by deep learning systems, by machine learning systems. And right now, increasingly, companies can't. The decision process for these machine learning systems has gotten so complex and so intricate that quite often how you get from the inputs to the outputs is not explicable. And we see weird manifestations of it. You know, why does my, you know, why does the Tesla keep mistaking the moon for a traffic light? You know, why is it that the self-driving system can navigate across the country but can't back out of my garage without hitting the wall? Or if you talk to any programmer, you know, John, I'm sure you've experienced this. Very often, there'll be a program or software that they're writing that they remove a line or a segment that they know doesn't affect anything, and the program won't compile. But they put that quote unquote useless code back in, and suddenly the program compiles again. It's baffling. It's incomprehensible. But we see so many examples of incomprehensibility around, you know, whether it manifests as ridiculousness, you know, the people who think that COVID was a hoax, or think that, you know, John F. Kennedy is coming back or something, you know, really ridiculous thoughts, whether it's senseless, you know, the various kinds of mass shootings and the kinds of violence that just simply don't make sense. And even the people who are perpetrating them can't explain.
You know what's even crazier? People thinking not that just that John F. Kennedy would come back, but that if he came back, he would come to Dallas.
He'd come to right. Yeah, please. Or unthinkable. You know, I don't know if you guys know how close we came to a nuclear exchange just a couple of weeks ago.
No.
You know, because the Putin, you know, Russia has a
not really surprised, though.
An explicit policy of what they term escalate to de-escalate. That is, use a small or a set of small nuclear weapons in military contexts that don't have, you know, a significant civilian impact as a way of signaling seriousness so that your opponent, the United States in this case, would back off. You know, we're willing to go this far. Are you willing to step up from this? And there were signals that this process was underway, that basically Russia was getting ready to take that step. They have backed off from that. And then they came out recently, you know, more recently with an explicit statement that they will not be using nuclear weapons, which is great. Yeah, I'm very happy about that.
If it's true.
There are all sorts of things coming up that may or may not be true, but I know that the escalate to de-escalate is true. That's been Russian policy since 2002. Putin even wrote an essay around it about that time. So I use unthinkable in the classic Herman Kahn thinking the unthinkable sense. You know, Herman Kahn wrote the book on thermonuclear weapons back in 64, 65. It was one of the first articulations of scenario thinking. And that was, you know, thinking the unthinkable was the title of the book, or was the subtitle of the book. And this is, so we have these four, you know, angels of chaos, you know, the brittle, anxious, nonlinear, incomprehensible, not as structures that can tell us what to do. You know, these don't tell you what to do, but what they provide is a language to describe the chaos in which we are surrounded. And so I came up with this Banny concept, talked about it a bit, did a quick write-up that got put up on Medium in 2020, and it has exploded. Particularly in the developing world. Just in the last year, I've done over a dozen talks for organizations, mostly but not exclusively in the developing world, just explaining this Banny concept. If you put Banny as a term on YouTube, you will come up, you know, literally with over 100 videos made by people with no connection to me, who are explaining this for their audience, whether it's academics or business people, mostly but not exclusively in Brazil, in South America. I'm scheduled to give a remote talk to a university in Sri Lanka in a couple of months that has actually created an entire symposium around the Banny concept.
This sounds like the sort of thing that you might...
surreal to me. I'm sorry?
This sounds like the sort of thing you might get from the Santa Fe Institute, in other words, related to complexity. It seems like this is really about the complexity of the situation we're in, the complexity and the chaos.
Yeah, well, the reason I've avoided using the term complexity is because it's the C in VUCA, and I don't want to have too much confusion just around that. But broadly speaking, you're right that this is very much a description of a way of articulating how do we respond to a truly complex situation, a meta-complex situation. And one of the biggest questions I get is, well, what do we do? How do we turn this into action? And this is not a way of constructing a business model. You're not going to take Banny and turn that into a checklist of business plans, which is actually had a talk rejected because they wanted something more concrete like that. What I've been arguing is that actually the responses to that have to be much more human focused. We have to have responses that focus on intuition, on resilience, on improvisation, and most importantly, empathy. Yeah, the little in joke there is that it's the Irie response to Banny. The intuition, I just gave a big talk for a group in Mexico yesterday, an hour long talk on Banny. And one of the examples I used around intuition, are you guys familiar with a guy named Stanislav Petrov?
I've heard the name. I'm not really familiar with his work.
He was a Russian or Soviet air defense soldier working at a radar installation, an early warning system installation in the 1980s. In 84, literally.
Oh, that's where I heard it. I remember now. Yeah.
Yeah, literally a month after the KAL-007 was shot down, the Korean Airlines jet was shot down by the Soviet Union. Tensions were at a high between U.S. and Soviet Union. Petrov got an alert that five missiles were incoming from the United States. That the radar had picked up five incoming ICBMs. Petrov knew that if he sent this up the chain of command, if he followed the rules about what he was supposed to do, it's very likely that there would have been an automated response that essentially did a full retaliation and would have been the beginning of a global thermonuclear war, the end of the world. And he also knew that, despite how serious the issues were between the U.S. and the Soviets right now, if the U.S. was going to launch a first strike, they wouldn't just do five missiles. It would be an overwhelming attack. So he didn't send the message up the chain. And of course, within a few minutes, it was very clearly a glitch in the system. But for his good judgment, he was drummed out of the military, given a pension off to some small village in Siberia. He lived a fine life. He died a few years ago. He wasn't imprisoned or anything like that, but he was definitely not celebrated for having avoided ending the world. But that's very much what he did, not based on logic so much as his intuition, his gut feeling that this didn't seem right. This felt wrong. And that kind of intuition, I think, is increasingly critical in a chaotic environment, in a Banny world.
That sounds right out of the script for the old movie War Games. And
it does.
The real life version of that movie,
right? And in this case, there were no artificial intelligent computers involved asking to play a game, but there was a system that didn't know what was really happening, and relied on human judgment. And I think we are, in the situation we're in right now, human judgment is critical, and it's not being exercised well. But I think the most important of those four, of the four in the Irie, is empathy. The capacity to recognize the humanness of others, to recognize that, that people have their own lives and they have larger issues than simply the interaction with you at that moment. A very small example is when somebody cuts me off in traffic, I don't know if they're off to the hospital. I don't know if they're trying to desperately get home or they're trying to just to get ahead of everybody. They may be jerks. They may be desperate. I don't want to assume. And so that just that little step of, I'm going to extend this bit of empathy to people because I don't know what they're going through, but they might be going through something terrible. And I think that that's one of the best ways that in the workplace for people to, you know, for organizations to work with their stakeholders, their employees in particular, in amidst this chaos, is to extend a bit of empathy and say, yeah, this is a really screwed up situation. Let's try something different.
Yeah, I mean, we've had a complete lack of empathy modeled for us from the top. About Trump, you know, and it seems to be infectious.
It does. Viral hatred. I don't know. It is seeing these four elements, the intuition, resilience, improvisation, and empathy as the counters to a banny world. Adds to the frustration and fear, I think. You know, adds to my sense, I don't want to say hopelessness, but despair. I did a talk a few years ago on climate where I said, you know, we needed, and it wasn't about the technology or the geophysics, it was mostly about the human reaction of rage, grief, and misery. And it's just, how do we respond to a chaotic world? Very often, it's a sense of powerlessness. It emerges from powerlessness. It emerges from a sense of being betrayed by the systems. The systems aren't just failing, they're betraying us. And so with all of this swimming around in my head, I've been trying to hold on to a little bit of hope amidst this world of chaos and misery. So that's how I've been doing, John. How have you been doing?
Do you think about the role of media in all this? We talk about that quite a bit.
I'd imagine that media is such a broad term. And I think the different manifestations, different platforms and types of media, whether it's a mass broadcast media, broadcast, you know, metaphorically over cable, broadcast media or one-to-one media or social media, one to millions, millions to one. Each of these affects us in different ways. I think that social media in particular has a number of pathologies that have recently been, that have been heightened by short-term profit-making, but has a number of, you know, pathological impacts that have made anxiety worse for a lot of people. I think that malinformation, you know, misinformation in particular, is enhanced by a lot of our media platforms because it generates anger and fear. And it turns out that the brain responds more quickly with anger and fear than it does with empathy. I mean, there's
that's
some
really
really
it.
Interesting.
I mean, you can sell fear better than you can sell empathy.
Right. Because, you know, there is actually a neurological process that responds more quickly, more swiftly to fear and anger. And so if you have platforms that are based purely on the generation of short-term profit, then very quickly you're going to start steering towards platforms that help to trigger these kinds of fear and anger responses, because those generate more clicks, those generate more hits on your advertising, generates more eyeballs for your channel. I don't know if you saw Jacinda Ardern in New Zealand the other day was asked why New Zealand doesn't have the same kind of angry white middle-aged guy problem that pretty much all the rest of the West has. He says, we never allowed Rupert Murdoch to set up a media platform here.
Yeah, Murdoch is definitely a source of a lot of this. You know, we idealistically thought in the early days of the internet that we're creating something like the noosphere, the Teilhard de Chardin concept of the noosphere. And it didn't occur to us that the noosphere could just be insane.
Yes. You know, you folks undoubtedly remember John Perry Barlow's Declaration of Independence of Cyberspace. It's charming. to look back on that now. It's some combination of charming and painful to look back on that now. Painful not because he was wrong, but just because the hopes that were so clear and have been failed and have failed so thoroughly. One of the things that we celebrated early on, I think, and is worth celebrating about the internet and the connections between people that the internet has enabled, is it has given voice to the voiceless, to groups that have been oppressed or suppressed in their local physical communities. We're able to find connections with each other online, and you're able to create long distance community around marginalized cultures, marginalized beliefs, marginalized practices. I don't think we would see the degree of support for gay rights in the West, and increasingly for transgender rights in the West, without the internet enabling people to connect with each other. What we forgot is that some groups are marginalized for a reason. Some groups are better off marginalized, and these neo-Nazi groups, these hate groups, the Q cultists. These voices are just as empowered by the internet as the voices that we're happy to see empowered. And you can't get one without the other, unfortunately, or it's very difficult to get one without the other. And I don't know where to go from there. One of the things that's really frustrating as a futurist is that it's really hard to see a path forward.
As a futurist, has the view forward really shortened because things are so chaotic that you really can't predict too much into the future because it's so subject to change with no notice?
Well, that to an extent, that's always been the issue. For a lot of futurists, predict is a bad word. It's the P word. What we do is forecast, and most often we do that with scenarios of multiple different kinds of futures. So we have our present day situation. Let's talk about the cone of possibility and the cone of plausibility that's a bit wider than that. And, what are the different kinds of futures we might see? I'm actually writing a piece right now on the value of being wrong. If you're a futurist, you're going to be wrong. The goal is to be usefully wrong. And so to an extent, not being able to say with certainty about what will happen is a part of the job. What has been most frustrating, aggravating, devastating, some combination of the above for me has been the inability to really forecast good medium-term scenarios. It's easy to forecast bad short-term scenarios. We get a lot of those, we get through them pretty quickly. But we usually are able to say, okay, but in the medium term, in the 10-year cycle, 10 to 20-year cycle, which for futures is the medium term, we can see these kinds of improvements happening. We can see these kinds of developments that might steer us away from catastrophe. It's becoming harder and harder to see that short or that medium term future in a beneficial context, because so many of the issues that are short term problems just simply get worse. And because they're systemic as opposed to situational or material, they're very difficult to resolve. And so what we see is this surreal moment of having so many great, positive developments. I mean, there are actually a lot of really good things happening right now. mRNA vaccines, the mRNA technologies around healthcare are amazing with their possibilities. We are at a point in the acceleration of the adoption of renewable energy that's far and away better than where we ever expected to be at this point in time. Solar and wind are cheaper than any other kind of energy on the planet, period. I remember talking to folks from the World Energy Agency 15 years ago, and they were saying, oh no, solar and wind won't be competitive. Renewables won't be competitive until at least 2050. And it's like, you know, I wonder if they remember those conversations now, because right now we are moving far more rapidly into renewable energy than we ever thought we would. There are developments in food production. Now, I don't know if you guys have probably heard of or even talked about cultured meat, you know, the kind of real meat that comes from that doesn't come from a living animal. And it's been talked about for years. It's now starting to hit markets. There are chicken nuggets for sale in Singapore that are cultured meat. No chicken actually evolved other than the initial DNA. The impact on water use, on land use, on methane output, all of that can be so massively and quickly improved by a shift over to this alternative source of protein. Yeah, you know, aside from the massive ethical improvements, you know, there are these facts, these realities of the moment that are really that help to keep us a little optimistic, that are beneficial to our societies. But then you look at the systems, you know, the underlying systems around the underlying issues around economic inequality, the underlying issues around trade access, water access, the underlying issues around climate. God, climate is far and away the biggest issue. I've been beating that drum for a while, but that increasingly I'm seeing other futurists beat that same drum of we have to pay attention, we have to deal with climate. It is in every scenario. It is in every future that we imagine as futurists is how do we deal with climate? And as great as it is to accelerate our renewable energy adoption, remember what I said about hysteretic processes. You know, as fast as we're going, we still have a lag between our actions and the consequences. And so we're not just trying to fix things and seeing a better future in the short term, because that is not possible due to physics. We're trying to fix things so that at the very least, our medium to long-term futures can be better. Our grandchildren's futures can be better. We're hosed for the next 10 to 20 years, climate-wise. Yep. There's nothing we can do to avoid really radically bad outcomes over that next 10 to 20 years. And what we're really aiming for now is trying to make sure that the second half of the century isn't even more apocalyptic.
Well, talk about apocalyptic technologies. Cryptocurrency. What have you seen in cryptocurrency that is either good or bad?
Cryptocurrency is it's multi-level marketing for guys. My take on cryptocurrency is that it is far more likely that you're going to encounter a hoax or a rug pull, I think is the term in the community, where you get set up to buy a bunch of stuff and then the people behind it pull the rug out from under you and they run away with the money and you get stuck with some bits. There's so much deception and hackery in the least good sense involved in the cryptocurrency world that I honestly haven't been paying close attention other than to make derisive comments. There's a video that came out a few months ago with Line Goes Up that's on YouTube. It's pretty easy to find because everyone was just loving it. It's 2 hours long. But it's one of the best examinations of cryptocurrency and NFTs and that whole phenomenon I've ever seen. And I feel like I'm not losing out by not immersing myself in the world of crypto. You know, there's a chance I'm wrong. You know, maybe we'll come back and have a conversation in 5 years and I'll be really kicking myself for not having invested in Dogecoin or something.
Well, I made a little money on cryptocurrency, but I think it's at least volatile and unstable, if not scammy.
Yeah. I mean, and the idea that it can be, that it can serve as a replacement for a financial system. You know, one of the things I,
if they were actually doing that, I might have more confidence, but that's not what's happening.
No. One of the best comments I've seen about crypto is that the world of cryptocurrency is giving us a real-time education on why regulations happen.
Indeed.
Why the financial system is, the conventional financial system is so heavily regulated. Well, what you're seeing happening in crypto is why these regulations were developed.
Well, I'm tempted to create a cryptocurrency and call it Ponzi. Just cut to the chase. So.
Might as well be transparent.
Exactly.
So, Jamay, I had some interaction with the Government Futures Lab, and Jake Dunnigan and I have had a lot of conversations about the future of governance. Do you incorporate much political analysis into the work that you do?
Oh, yeah.
Because that really seems to be the crux of the matter, huh?
You know, politics is about power. Politics is the process of trying to mutually agree upon a distribution of power, you know, and the power's ability to make someone do what they otherwise would not do.
That's when it is when it works properly, right?
Well, yes, but if you try to apply power and the person or your partner does not do what they otherwise would not do, they continue not to do it, you haven't applied enough power or the right kind of power. And I know that's a really kind, almost cynical, is literally Machiavellian take on this. But I did international politics in grad school, so that's my background. It is difficult to, that's actually one of the reasons why it's so hard to have a positive view of the future right now. It's not because, again, it's not because we don't know what to do. It's not because we don't have the tools or the capacity. It's because we don't have the political desire, the political willingness to do it, or the political structure that allows us to do it. I mean, there probably is a significant majority of people on the world, in the United States, that want to do something, that are willing to do something big and meaningful and, you know, perhaps short-term harmful with the long-term benefit around climate, but not at the level of political leadership, because that's not what our system has elevated.
Well, there's not a sufficient economic interest in doing that, right?
And there's certainly not a sufficient short-term economic interest.
And economics are driving everything. Financialization is a big deal right now. I mean, that's what troubles me, is that we seem to be like in a kind of downward spiral here into a move into autocratic governance that we can't quite, it's like when a plane is crashing, there's some period of time where you can maybe correct it and maybe avoid the crash. But the more crashy the crash becomes, the less you're able to recover. And that's kind of the way I'm feeling about things right now.
Yeah, I did a talk last year. I don't know how much, when you spoke with Jake, I don't know how much he talked about this scenario archetype model out of the University of Hawaii's future studies program, where he got his doctorate. The notion is that when you think scenarically, when you think about different future possibilities, inevitably you end up with four different archetypes of what those futures could be. A growth future, which usually gets used as a beneficial future, but can be the growth of anything. It can be the growth of, you know, a pandemic disease. But a growth future, a restrictive future, or a discipline future, where you have to control what is done, a collapse future, and a transformation future. And so in this talk that I did, I said, if you look at the scale of change needed to deal with these systemic problems, growth is a pathological path, because a lot of the issues that we have right now come from our models of growth. The discipline or restriction future delays things, but doesn't solve things. the collapse future, well, we can just get extra collapsey collapse. But transformation is what remains. So everything else results in collapse eventually. We need a transformation. And so that's the underlying driver for what I do, is I'm trying to inculcate in people's minds the scale of the challenge and the need for transformation. Not just the need, our capacity to transform. One analogy that I often use, and I love, that we often use dinosaur as a negative, as a disparaging comment. Oh, that company is a dinosaur. That, that industry is a dinosaur, because you think, oh, they're about to go extinct. No, dinosaurs were remarkably successful. Dinosaurs were around for 150 million years and then became birds. Dinosaurs dealt with the mass extinction of the Cretaceous-Paleogene event by evolving into birds. They're incredibly, remarkably successful and an example of transformation under the most horrific circumstances. So I want to be a dinosaur, because I'd love to see our society transform under pressure like that.
I would mind being a bird.
Dinosaurs transformed into oil also.
No, actually, I know what you're saying, but actually, I'm going to oil is primarily a plant matter from the Paleozoic, the eras before dinosaurs. So,
Seems to me that what we need is to have a better distribution of understanding. It seems like part of the problem is that people don't really, generally, the people who would even need to have the understanding, I suppose leaders, they don't. And the people at various levels of society that could support them also don't have understanding, partly because there's so much fog in the air, So the question is, how do you clear the fog? And that's back to the thing about media I was saying, sort of like if you think of the concept of something like an infosphere, if the infosphere is flooded with shit, to use Steve Bannon's, phraseology, how do you address that, especially if you have something like Rupert Murdoch, something like Fox News? I know you have a solution for this, right?
Oh, yeah, but you won't like it.
No.
Most of the pathways that most quickly deal with this kind of situation are authoritarian. One of the unfortunate truths about authoritarian or autocratic systems is that they can move quickly. That doesn't mean they move correctly, but they can move quickly. And the ability to quickly remove the shit from the atmosphere will, the faster you want to get it done, the more you're going to require top-down power to do it.
Yeah, I'm very aware that we had Trump because of democracy.
Yeah.
The more democratic we got, the closer we got to having that kind of election,
People like instant gratification.
Yeah, instant gratification, exactly. But it's also, they want understanding. I think John was just talking about understanding. They want understanding, but what they want is understanding that makes them feel better. I can think about, the whole logic behind Q and the conspiracy theories. It's a lot of this is around chaos and not having an understanding of why all this is happening, because you can't. It's incomprehensible. And so by grabbing onto something like the Q conspiracy, by grabbing onto these different narratives about the world that are patently untrue, but are internally consistent, or at least, within a range of argument, internally consistent, that allow you to understand what's happening, allow you to see that there are people who are making decisions. They may be bad decisions, they may be evil people, but it's not just happening because reality is random. It's happening because someone is in charge.
Yeah, so it's more comfortable to have an idea of this conspiracy than it is to think that they were just in chaos.
Yeah, it is. And I think to an extent, I think that the reaction to the Banny concept is a parallel process. There's a parallel manifestation because it's about trying to understand and grapple with chaos, trying to give language to and structure to this sense of randomness in our world.
There's a concept, pronoia, which is the opposite of paranoia, the idea that the universe is out to help you and not out to get you. If we had more conspiracy theories that were sort of pronoiac conspiracy theories, maybe that would be part of a solution.
Well, I think I have my next year planned out now. Try to come up with something like that and get it spread around. The goal with any kind of foresight work, any kind of scenarios or futures work, is to provoke you into looking differently at the world. You know, the term that I like to use because it sounds fancy is, you know, scenarios and forecasts are epiphany engines. You know, they are meant to trigger in you, be catalyst for you having an entirely new view of the world. You have that aha, well, I never saw it that way moment. And the idea with all of these forecasts is not to tell you, you know, this one has a 33.2% chance of happening. It's to say, this is something in the realm of plausibility. How would you respond? What does this mean to you? And that's actually true for nearly every scenario project I've worked on over the past 25 years. The goal isn't to tell you what this is, what will happen. The goal is to say, here's something that could happen. How would you deal with this? What kinds of changes can you make to make this more or less likely? What kind of changes can you make to make your position in this world better? And how would those affect you in this other world? You know, are there changes you can make? Are there actions you can take now that would be successful across a spectrum of different futures?
Because one way I saw it, and that was when I had some alignment with corporate futurism, or strategic forecasting, really. Mm-hmm. And it seemed to me that the thing you would do, at least for a corporation, for a business that has a specific business, was lay out the scenarios for the future and kind of let them pick the scenario that they think fits their interests best and figure out how to work toward that outcome, you know?
So when I first started doing this, I worked primarily with a group called Global Business Network, Peter Schwartz, Stuart Brand, Lawrence Wilkinson, Napier Collins. Okay, those are the five guys who founded it. Peter's from Shell, was actually one of the people working on Shell's scenarios back in the 70s. A lot of the work we did had the impact of corporations trying to pick and choose their preferred scenario. But the argument that we made, and that is carried through across the different organizations I've worked with in my own work, is that it's all well and good to have something that you'd like to see happen. You need to be aware of and plan around the full range, because just because you don't want it to happen doesn't mean it won't. I had a client in for a group I worked with in 2000 that told us at the outset, we don't want any bad scenarios. We just want a set of scenarios of success, because if things go bad, well, we're just gone. Well, things went bad and they were gone because they had absolutely no mental preparation for a downturn in the economy. And so what I try to do with my forecast work, with the scenario work, with the scenarios that I write, whether for a particular project or for big picture, here's a possibility or a set of possibilities about the world. The goal isn't to tell you, again, is not to tell you this will happen. We'll say, here's a possibility. You may see it as more or less plausible, but it's a possibility. What does this mean for you? How do you change the way you lived in this world? How does it force you to change? What can you do to make this better? And how does that apply across a spectrum of futures? Ideally, when you do forecast work, scenario work with an organization, you don't just do it once. You do it on a repeating basis every 5 years, every 3 years, whatever. You know, Shell does them every 10 years. You do them, and you, each future doesn't have to be an iteration of a, your previous set of scenarios. It's a reevaluation of what do we see as possible outcomes from our present course, from the present choices we have. Because scenarios are all about implications and consequences. You know, it's not about options, it's not about plans. It's about what are the consequences? What are the unintended, unexpected, surprising, painful, beneficial consequences of the choices we're making today, of the systems that are swirling around us today, the chaos in which we reside, the chaos in which we work.
I think we're close enough to the end of our hour that if I asked you another question, we'd go over. So we're like over 2 minutes away, but in the last 2 minutes, do you have anything you want to add before we close?
It's not bad to have despair, but you can't let that be your sole feeling about the future. Despair is a completely reasonable response to what you see in the world around you. It's important, though, to balance that despair with the recognition that the possibility is there for a better world. We know what to do. I just keep coming back to that again and again. We know what to do. It's not a question of trying to figure it out. It's not a question of trying to, you know, see, you know, otherwise in otherwise blind of our trying to see what where we can go. We know where to go. We know what to do. We can do it. We just have to decide to do it. And you may feel a bit of despair, you may feel a bit of misery, you may feel a lot of grief, but you can't stop feeling some hope.
Thank you so much, Jamay. This has been a great talk.
Thank you for having me.
You can follow the Plutopia News Network at plutopia.io. On Facebook, go to @PlutopiaNews. On Twitter, it's @Plutopia. With John Lepkoski, I'm Scoop Sweeney. This is the Plutopia News Network, 20 minutes into the future.